All right, this means we are official and getting started. This is Dean Landsman, and it's May 2nd, and this is the VRM conference call. On the line with us so far are Joe Andrew, Paul Madsen, Keith Hopper, Ben Laurie, Leif Chastain. Leif, am I saying your last name right?
Correct, yes, thank you.
Thanks. Britt Blazer and Deb Schultz. Hope I didn't leave anybody out. And I'd like to start off with just a little bit of notes and points of interest. Doc cannot be on the call today because he is just returning from Brussels. He had the meeting in Brussels, which he said was really quite good. He had some interesting news, some of which is on hold until it can be announced, but there's some exciting things in the works. Britt Blazer, who's with us, called me, actually sent me a note to say he couldn't be here, but he's making a cameo appearance. And we thank Britt because he's been sponsoring transcripts of these calls. I send him the audio of the call, and so you're able to both listen to the audio when I post it and read the transcript, which I think I'm behind in posting, but I'll get to that. Joe, if I don't get to that, please remind me. A few other points is that points of note. The Public Radio Project is moving. It's moving along. There's some background work on that. Doc and I are working on that. Keith Hopper, who's on the call, is part of that. There's a few other people. So there is a little movement on that front. I do want to point out that most of the calls are up on the site, and if any aren't, I'll get them up today or tomorrow. And that's basically it. And what I'd like to do is leave this open. But Paul Madsen, you're here. Doc pointed out that you had some fascinating things to say about what Liberty is doing and ideas you had, and he thought that I should call on you on this call to get your input. And also there's some new voices here, so I'd like to encourage new voices to speak. And Paul, I'd like to throw the ball to you.
Sure. So you mentioned the Brussels session that Doc was at last week. I was at the same session, so I represent my company in the Liberty Alliance, and Liberty Alliance has been around about 5-6 years now, looking at identity on the web and trying to define specifications and business guidelines and policy guidelines for building new identity systems on the web, both B2C and government to citizen and enterprise. So the identity open space event that Doc attended last week in Brussels was co-sponsored by Liberty along with the Internet Identity Workshop, Doc and Phil and Kalia. So at that session, or during the IOS, Doc put up on the board that he wanted to talk about VRM and what it is, because for many in that community, they're not aware of VRM, but what it is, what the principles are, and so forth. Now, I knew a little bit about VRM beforehand, and I had roughed out some basic ideas of how Liberty's architecture, might be applicable to VRM, and how we could support the types of use cases that in my limited understanding of VRM are relevant. So I went in to Doc's session with some ideas about how our architecture, what Liberty refers to as our identity web services framework, might be applicable. And as Doc got into it, we had a really good discussion about that and how the different pieces of WSF might play in supporting VRM. Oversimplifying, in some sense, or I would see VRM, and you'll excuse my probably incorrect use of terminology, but as I understand it, a central concept of VRM is the idea of some personal RFP that, it's some statement that a user makes about the services or products that they're interested in. And, the VRM premise is that the user puts that out there and potential providers of that service or goods find him or her rather than the alternative. So it kind of flips the model that we currently live under. So if that's the model, I would see my personal RFPs as just another slice of my identity that I put out on the web, similar to, the calendars that I might make public or my personal profile with shipping address and email and so forth, my geolocation, my presence, my set of friends. My RFPs, or Doc had a different acronym for them, I can't remember, but I would put those out on the web, and I'd make them available so that providers could find them and analyze them and discover within those, my RFPs, a potential match with what they were looking to provide me. And WSF, Web Services Framework, at its most basic, is just plumbing a set of services and security mechanisms and privacy mechanisms for making that sort of identity, different aspects of a user's identity, available and in a secure and privacy-respecting manner. So, as I said, oversimplifying, VRM would be just one application, or could be just one application, that took advantage of our framework for moving identity around. So, any questions?
Oh, this is Brett. I'm curious if you're going to have some special expression of it on your site and sort of publicize it.
Well, so definitely. I think, so the Liberty Alliance is a standards body in one sense. So we define standards that companies can use to implement federated identity and identity services. So, if Project VRM were to get interested in the relevance of Liberty standards for VRM, then I would definitely imagine that Liberty would want to highlight that and brag about that application of our work. But that's, I think that's that piece of it, at least, is in the future. I think we're still just in the stage of trying to learn what both sides might offer the other.
Paul, what of the existing VRM standards do you think would be immediately applicable, the Liberty standards to VRM?
So I would imagine that a piece of work that the VRM community has ahead of themselves is to define an XML syntax for what this RFP looks like. Somehow identifying some product number, somehow, tagging it with useful metadata, maybe a SKU number. Somehow you've got a user's got to be able to describe what they want to buy and their terms and conditions on doing so, maximum price, when they need it by, and so forth. Liberty's web service framework really is a set of web services, SOAP-based web services, for moving around that type of identity-centric XML document. So we have XML schemas that stipulate what a calendar event might look like. And so all of Liberty's architecture really is plumbing for allowing that calendar description or calendar event description to be shared between websites in a secure and, privacy-appropriate manner. So in some sense, all of Liberty's plumbing is relevant to VRM. One piece in particular that I presented on a couple of months ago, there was a Liberty event co-located with a VRM meeting in Redwood City. And at that time, I talked about the relevance of what Liberty calls our people service to VRM use cases. So my, once again, limited understanding of VRM is that, at least for now, you've focused on use cases where there's a single user in the mix. It's Alice advertising what Alice wants to buy so that stores and service providers can find her and make her an offer. So I explored the relevance of social use cases where, Alice may stipulate that she wants a trip to the Caribbean, but it's Alice's dad who wants to negotiate the price because he's going to pay for it as some graduation gift for Alice. So I think that the social layer that Liberty defines could be really interesting for VRM as well. Just one last thing. So on the VRM wiki, somewhere down there, there's a page called Technology, I believe. And a couple of months ago, I roughed out how I thought Liberty's architecture could work for VRM, and I just tried to draw out the different pieces of our architecture and a sequence of steps by which the architecture could support a basic VRM use case. So that's on the. Yeah, it should. It's strange. If you go there, you'll have to go to the. You go to the revision history, and the second last version is there. The most recent version of that page is blank.
Hmm. I've noticed that on another page, so maybe we should just revert that change that made it blank.
And if
someone on here knows of a good reason why that was blanked out, feel free to switch that back.
Okay.
I mean, if someone here would speak up about it, we could talk about the edit, but I'm not sure why that happened, and it sounds like good content, so I'd like to see it back, certainly.
It is my theory that, and I mean this not to be humorous, that there are some ghosts in the machine on that wiki that just change things.
Well, I think it's also just the nature of needing to constantly groom these types of public access documents.
All right. I'd like to follow up, Paul, on the concept of social use cases. Do you have any other thoughts of this? You know, my knee-jerk, fearful reaction when you said social use cases was, oh, no, a way for this to turn into CRM and data mining and undermine the goal here, because we really don't want to be in a position where we're gathering data that turns into mining work. But I'm curious as to other social use cases that you might be able to present or at least, you know, suggest as possibilities.
So the use cases that got me thinking about it were gift registries. You know, I'm a newlywed, or I'm not a newlywed, but I'm a bride or a groom, perhaps, if he has an opinion. And he registers the goods that the couple wants for their wedding. Now, gift registries currently would work on the assumption that the people once invited to the wedding would go to Walmart or whatever the store is, and if they wanted to access the couple's gift registry, they'd create an account and be able to see what was on the list and what had already been purchased. So the motivation for people service in Liberty's architecture is to enable that sort of resource sharing between friends and families and colleagues, but do so without the invited person, in this case the wedding guest, having to create a new account at the site. So the model would be that the bride would be able to effectively manage her wedding list through Liberty-based mechanisms and be able to specify to the wedding registry that, I want these 20 people to be able to see my registry. Those 20 people would be able to access the registry, on the assumption that it's semi-private and protected information that wouldn't be public, so that they'd be able to get in there and see it. But once that social relationship had been established between the bride and the wedding guests, then a VRM system could then kick in and be able to, retrieve the guests' preferences with respect to what they were willing to pay, for instance. Maybe, and this is a little bit dubious, maybe the wedding guests have advertised on their own site their limitations and price restrictions for attending this wedding. And some semi-automatic bot goes out and tries to match the desires of the bride against the monetary restrictions of the wedding guests. So I think there's, to be honest, I was trying to argue this social case for the novelty of it and trying to portray the value of WSF to VRM. But I think there's plenty of value in just the simpler single user cases. The social layer is a new piece of functionality we've added to our architecture, and we're kind of proud of it, so we talk about it whenever we can, even perhaps when we shouldn't.
Does anyone else, having heard that, does anyone else have thoughts about social cases? I'm fascinated by this. My mind is kind of reeling. I'm curious if anyone else has thoughts about social cases.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on a way that I think would be easy to extend this with the current technology, but I'm not sure I understand it. So there's also the need for the bride and the groom, but to not know that others have bought items on this registry, but for other guests to know that. And if I understand correctly, that's at the application level, such that someone providing a registry using this people service could provide that sort of filtering.
I would think that's essentially an access control issue by the wedding registry provider, right?
So
knowing who's who,
could
and
say, yes, I bought this item that was on the registry, and the bride and groom wouldn't be able to access that, but other
right.
guests would.
Yeah. To me, the basic justification or motivation for the social piece was, if I think about an RFP, there's kind of two very different pieces of information in that RFP. There's what I want and what I'm willing to pay, you know, oversimplifying again. In a social use case, one user says what they want, but it's somebody else who says what they're willing to pay. So how do you reconcile those two probably opposing views, and how do you even find the information on what the payer is willing to pay? And so I was just trying to tease out issues in VRM that I hadn't seen talked about before.
I like that.
This is
Lisa.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that there's a link to the presentation where I tried to explore these ideas, and I'll send it out to the – I'll put it on the wiki after.
All right. I'd also suggest that when you put it on the wiki, please also send the note to the mailing list with a link. Because,
sure.
Not to speak ill of our wiki, but there are times that getting from point A to point B can be a daunting task.
Okay.
See, that was the dog agreeing how difficult it is to find things on the wiki. All right, somebody else was about to speak.
Yeah, so this is Luke Chastain. Two comments, actually. One is on the price. Actually, this is kind of an interesting scenario where, if you kind of think of things in terms of the personal, personal RFP, a couple of interesting things come out, and Chris and I actually spent quite a lot of time talking about that this week. One of which is that there's obviously everything you mentioned in terms of, how do you structure that document, but I think an important aspect as well is the dictionary in terms of being able to, when you describe something you're looking for, being able to describe it in the terms that others are going to be able to translate. The other interesting thing is, I don't think that there needs to be, I would posit that one scenario is that there doesn't need to be any sort of means of reconciling offered price versus acceptance price versus what someone's willing to pay. If the personal RFP is done in a way in which mechanical, or which, the RFP can be handled and churned by a machine, which, to be honest, is probably what it would take to get the attention and interest of the vendors that are out there. The person submitting the RFP obviously is just simply in a position where he can either, accept, take the conversation to the next level, or whatever the next appropriate means of disposition for the responses is. And, ultimately, whether that ends up in kind of a, offer acceptance model or move to negotiation model, I don't know that any of that'll change.
No, I agree.
It's an RFP.
Yeah, I agree. I said reconcile, but what I really meant was, if you've got the owner of the RFP stipulating what they want, and in these social use cases, you've got somebody else stipulating what the maximum price is. The challenge for the VRM system is to find out who those other people are and what they're willing to pay. So you need mechanisms for discovering the guests, and where their RFP wedding guest price threshold is, for want of a better name. And
sure.
It's those mechanisms that our architecture is designed to provide. But,
so,
but not to address the application level of how you match those up.
Right, yeah. Which obviously is a little bit challenging. and then the one other comment I'd throw in is just in terms of the social case. You know, the concept of an RFP can be extended to just about anything. So as an example, perhaps I'm working on a business plan or I'm working on a concept, and I want to put out an RFP, if you will, just for information. I'm dreaming of putting this business together. I'm looking for people who have an interest in similar things.
Yeah.
And I think it's a different take, a different spin from what you were talking about. But I think it's also that type of ability to use that same mechanism to facilitate social interactions between individuals, not necessarily between individuals and companies, I think is equally interesting and, viable within this type of a framework.
Yeah, that's definitely different. I mean, as you describe it, that's sort of implicit social based on the RFP, as opposed to the explicit social relationships that we typically think about.
Exactly, yeah.
So I welcome the chance to talk to everybody about this. I'm interested to see what further explorations we can move forward on.
So I have a question. There's been conversations about the use case of sort of a generalized personal data silo, and it seems to me that this trivially fits into this architecture.
It does. I mean, sometimes silo is used disparagingly, but in the industry, in the identity industry at least. So our architecture starts on the assumption that a user has pieces of their identity distributed across the network at appropriate providers. And the challenge for any application that wants to get at some of that information is find out where it is and then be able to request it. And so the Liberty model is that you've got these, application or logic specific silos out in the network, and you want to be able to tie all that identity information together into useful applications. So
I could specify, to be more concrete, I could specify that I want Amazon and Netflix to both have, assuming I have some sort of identity identifier for them, I could specify that they have some sort of read and perhaps read-write access to my movie history?
Exactly.
And ratings, I guess?
Any particular slice of
identity.
Have to
build a bundle around this movie rating system, but the Liberty framework, specifically this people services, could enable me to let both Netflix and Amazon access my data silo that I'm maintaining with some provider.
Exactly, except that more typically the people service would be used by you to allow who of your friends and family can see your movie list rather than Amazon or eBay. If for the latter, you would typically just define an access rule at your movie list provider. Or similarly, at your VRM provider, you would define what are the conditions for that provider to release your RFPs. I would think that some of those RFPs would be, freely available. Anybody can look at them. Others, if it's sensitive information, your private hobbies, then maybe you want to tighten up that access. So we've tried to support all those, that range of privacy.
Now, is anyone looking at how in this architecture I would, for example, be able to say, I want any legitimate movie service to have access to this, and only define it sort of at that level? Is there anyone who's maintaining or suggesting that they might maintain this ability to resolve what's a valid movie service?
No. So, yeah, it's an interesting problem, and it's not specific to movie services. How do you define trust in terms of reputation or something more abstract than just listing providers? That's a challenge. That sort of infrastructure could be layered, that trust model could be layered on top of Liberty. We're thinking more and more about the relevance of the people service, our social bit, to sort of reputation-based networks. So, for instance, you might not define your access control in terms of a particular friend, but you might say that anybody who my friends say is okay can see my movie list.
Do you know anyone who's working on that as a service? I mean, is that something like maybe the Opinity guys are working on, or that?
So I think when Opinity looks at reputation, I think they're, and this may be wrong, but I think they're talking about reputation of individuals as opposed to service providers.
Right. Yeah, I almost want like Hoover's or D&B to provide some sort of categorization service.
Right. So Ping ID used to provide something of that sort for more business-oriented networks.
Let me turn this thought around a little bit. Let's just say I'm a vendor, and I want to offer this to my to buyers, consumers, users, customers, whatever we want to call them. And if anyone's offended in any of those terms, I seriously apologize. And I, by the way, find none of those terms offensive. The question is, how would we make this available to a vendor who very much wants to have VRM working for them or with them? And is there a way within the framework, Paul, that you described, we could make that operational?
So what one scenario is that when the user shows up at that vendor, the vendor wants to know what the user wants to buy, right? They want to facilitate that matching between what they sell and what the user wants. So the Liberty scenario would be that when the user authenticated to the vendor, they wouldn't sign in, or typically wouldn't sign in directly with a password and an account name at the vendor, but they would single sign in from their preferred identity provider. So if they maintain their identity at Google, then they'd authenticate to Google and then be able to jump over to Amazon or whatever the vendor is. And so as the user has single sign-on in, Amazon has the head start it needs to start finding out information about that user. So it might be interested, at some point in the process, it probably is going to be interested in the shipping address of the user. You know, it can ask for that once the user clicks on the purchase button. It might be interested in the geolocation of that user, because maybe it has some location-based services that it wants to pitch and sell. But in your scenario, first and foremost, what it wants to find out is what are the user's RFPs? Where are they, and what is the user interested in buying when they show up at Amazon? So Amazon kicks things off by first discovering, effectively by querying an identity search, would query for the location of that user's VRM providers. And there could be multiple ones, and you know, maybe one is optimized for electronics and one's optimized for other types of product categories.
To clarify real quick, so in this case, Google, as the identity provider, is keeping a list of those VRM providers?
By default, yes. So those So the scenario would be that all those various VRM providers would register themselves at Google and say, hey, I'm a VRM provider for this user, so that when Google received subsequent search queries for that user's VRM providers, it would be able to say, well, here's the list. Now, Amazon gets that list back from Google, and, you know, based on its own logic of what it's trying to sell, filters out those inappropriate VRM providers and sends a query, a SOAP message, to the chosen VRM provider, and it may well have asked the user, you know, for help in making that decision. But it sends a SOAP request and says, you know, what are Joe's RFPs? Maybe with this filter, electronics, or otherwise. What comes back is that XML document I talked about before that says what Joe's interested in buying. And at that point, Google looks through that document, parses it. You know, somehow, somebody pointed out earlier the challenge of knowing, being able to match what the user wants and what Google can offer, but that's, you know, that's a different challenge. But ultimately, Google's able to hopefully say, you know, to the user, well, I know you're looking for these three things, and here's my offer on two of them. That's kind of the base VRM scenario as supported by Liberty. There are other models where the discovery of the VRM is, or of the personal profile is more distributed, right? I guess in theory I could put my RFP document on my blog and just let Amazon's bots discover it and somehow then get in touch with me and make me an offer. Liberty's architecture isn't optimized for that, but it could be used there.
It strikes me that an opportunity that arises here, which is almost a mirror to what's going on in the identity initiative, in the identity world, is that we could perhaps set up a neutral and agnostic clearinghouse, not Google per se or Yahoo, for vendors and users to have a trusted, safe place where the user is the arbiter, and it would indeed use the tools you're describing, as in an XML syntax for RFPs, or frankly, syntax and a set of standards and practices that would both protect and distribute with users in mind.
Definitely. So Liberty's architecture sort of is optimized for that, the model of dedicated providers, you know, who concentrate on one slice of identity, whether it's geolocation or calendaring. And in this case, it'd be a dedicated and trusted VRM provider that a user would explicitly choose and say, you know, you are the one that I want to represent me in my dealings with the big vendors.
Is it so much the vendor providing representation, or is it more of a clearinghouse? Because as I think it through, the model that seems to make there's a couple of issues. The first is how do people who are vendors, which obviously could range from an individual in his garage to the Amazons of the world, find RFPs? Being issue one, and clearly clearinghouse could do that. And then the question is just, it seems like there'd be several options. One option would be to, obviously RFPs have to be discovered and filtered. You're going to throw them out there into a clearinghouse. So there has to be some mechanism for, quickly identifying what the scope or what the purpose of is the RFP, because you don't want, I don't think it would be architecturally sound to make the vendors have to filter, right, every single
right.
RFP.
Absolutely. So as I describe it, the default Liberty model is that the vendor discovers and queries the RFPs when the user shows up. So in that sense, there's no waste. The vendors aren't going out and retrieving RFPs from across the web on the chance that the user might show up, but the initiation of the interaction is by the user showing up at the vendor. Now, I don't think that's the – sorry, go.
So just a question around that, because you mentioned that before, and it sort of sprung a question. You know, one of the things, if you kind of think of about the way that we interact with companies today, and for that matter, just what the business models are out there. You have, you know, your auctions, your reverse auctions, eBay, Priceline. You've got your aggregators, guys like Amazon, and then you have your regular vendors. One of the things that I see VRM fixing is the absolute pain in the ass of trying to find things and find pricing and find, you know, whoever. So if I can put my RFP out there and never touch a vendor site until I've seen the responses come back and I already have a good idea of who I'm interested in interacting with, that model would be far preferable to having to go out and pick my vendors for the RFP in the first place. And I'm not sure that's what you're saying. So,
well, no, it's a good point. Yeah, so I definitely concede the advantages of the formal model as you described. The user does a bit of work and describes what they want and sits back and waits for the offers to come in. So I think Liberty's architecture could support that, but it would require, and it presumes that the user sort of makes their RFPs, if not completely public to, you know, some useful set of vendors that can discover it and retrieve it. So Liberty's model has always sort of veered towards the other side, where the identity attributes of a user are more closely held than would be required in the model as you describe it. Not to say that it couldn't support it, but it's just not what we've designed for.
There's an architecture that I've talked with Doc about, and I probably mentioned on these calls and elsewhere, that I think could easily address this within the basic Liberty Services framework, which is it needs a couple of things. We've talked about this idea of a class of vendors. Britt, you just mentioned, you know, the idea of making the RFP public to some set of vendors. So if I could say, you know, I only want, you know, authentic specialty gifts vendors to look at this, that would be one way to address that. We don't quite have that yet. Another way, or another component, is to separate what's private and public from the RFP such that there are tags or some sort of categorization built into the RFP that is public with a separate portion of what the actual RFP is. So I can say this is, you know, this is a rental car RFP, or this is a, you know, wedding gift RFP, or this is a car purchase RFP, in a way that's public and separate from the actual data in the RFP itself.
Right, that's a good point.
Those tags would be what vendors might filter on.
Exactly.
There's a third component, but I think that is that sort of dual architecture viable within the Liberty framework?
Absolutely. There's sort of a built-in assumption that the provider would filter information based on who's asking. And so it might be the case that the vendors go out and discover based on public tags, but once they want to go to the next level and, you know, actually retrieve the specifics, the SKUs and the price limits, that, you know, at that point they need to somehow prove that they're in some trusted list.
Right. Okay.
The challenge remains, though, when the vendors go out and discover these RFPs is, so once the vendor has said, yeah, this user is interested in something that I want, that I sell or provide, and I think we're within range of price, so we should talk, how does the vendor then initiate contact in a manner that doesn't completely throw away the privacy of the user?
Right. So this is a huge issue. In fact, we're grappling with this right now at my company in terms of how we let third parties collaborate with the searches that we're doing. We're doing search-related stuff. And one of the architectural models that flows in to what the third element I was going to highlight is basically – thinking of the RFP as a blog post, pinging some sort of central registry, like we ping Technorati today, for example, and then allowing some mechanism, again, bundled into some sort of identity access service for the vendor to essentially post a comment to that blog so that the comment as a feedback is how the vendor responds to that RFP.
Yeah, I think that works great if all aspects are public.
The blog engine as an application provider can filter the comments based on identity.
Sure, true.
I would posit that a different approach would be to specify, specify the response channel. If it's a private RFP, the response channel is my email or is, other private means of receiving that information. If it's not, then it doesn't necessarily need to be that way.
Or perhaps even a response channel that doesn't require the email to be freely given out, but still lets the user get the message. Some trusted proxy maybe.
Sure. Yeah, and actually that's where the clearinghouse concept actually starts to have a lot of merit, because then it can start to serve as that matchmaking, that matchmaking point.
Yep.
And also the clearinghouse needs to be agnostic in that the clearinghouse stands to gain nothing by making this match. The clearinghouse is solely, it's a neutral bot, and which I believe is critical for trust.
Yeah, to get the user has to trust that the clearinghouse is not filtering vendors on its own criteria, not the user's criteria.
So I can imagine a lot of potential scenarios there. But I did want to back up one and make one additional comment. I really, the whole notion of, I apologize not knowing everyone's name on the call, but to the person that made the comment regarding filterable tags that were publicly available. If you guys have seen or are familiar with the RosettaNet e-business specification, they defined a fairly heavy architecture, but one thing that they did do was sort of the message, the packing scheme for the message, which is essentially just an XML message, and it's actually an embedded message. So there's a private and a public portion of the message, the public portion having the routing and that sort of thing. But I think that same sort of concept might be viable here, just in terms of, I want people to be able to find rapidly what the intent of the RFP is and make it, make the document itself handleable while not exposing the contents. The only thing, not being a super technical type, is, how you handle the public key and the encryption issues with the private portion of the document. So. Just food for thought, and might be worth looking at if others haven't seen that yet.
So just to clarify, we talked about two extremes. One where the user shows up at the vendor, and from there that initiates the RFP discovery and subsequent offers. And the other extreme was the user just puts their RFPs in their blog and sits back and waits for the emails to come in. I guess maybe in the middle is a model where the user goes to the vendor once and says, you look like an okay vendor. I want you to know where my RFPs are, and I want to be notified in the future if and when you can make me an offer.
Just so, playing devil's advocate, the very first scenario, how is that different than, when I go to the airline today? And I do searching on routes.
So how is it different? I guess it's different in that the terms that you're willing to interact with those airlines, you don't have to re-enter them over and over at each airline you go to. You would create a trip RFP that says, this is where I want to go. I want two legs. I want to fly business class, and I'm a vegetarian. So instead of stipulating that at each airline you show up at, you store it once and reuse it.
Okay, got it. That's the distinction that I wasn't catching earlier.
Yeah, so it's not, I don't think it's the full, I don't think it provides the full advantages of the premise of VRM, but I think it's still useful.
Well, one thing I like about the first model is that if I'm a VRM kind of person and I'm using, you know, my personal RFPs, and then a vendor that I frequent anyway begins to support VRM, they could automatically start to access my RFPs that are out there and provide recommendations while I'm at their site for products maybe I didn't realize they had.
Exactly. And just to clarify what I think I did not present well earlier, you know, once that relationship is established with that vendor, you don't need to be online for them to subsequently find your new RFPs. They, in a sense, they need your help the first time, but afterwards you can stipulate what sort of rights they have the next time when you're not there, so that they can be subsequently looking for new additions to your RFP and or maybe they have a sale and they want you to know about it and so forth.
I think this actually gets into the issue I had mentioned a little earlier, which is how can we enable VRM for a vendor and keep them clean, honest, and righteous without them becoming just another data mining bullshit CRM operator. And I think actually we're approaching that. And it has to do with, again, I think it's access to the clearinghouse and permissions as defined by the user. And then manifested by the clearinghouse.
Well, I think it's more complicated than that because the user may not know that this is a bad vendor. So, you know, reputation is a possible answer to that. Unfortunately, lawsuits are also a possible answer to that. I mean, we don't necessarily know when a vendor is abusing the system.
And, you know, beyond lawsuits, there's regulatory realities and legal contracts. There's a whole range of ways, I think, to protect the user.
So I think there's some sort of need to start formalizing or clarifying what these, it's not best practices, that's not the word, but a way for users to specify the types of behaviors that are acceptable in some way to begin having commitments to those codes of behaviors or regulations or whatever we want to call them.
I think some of this would be learn-as-you-go procedure because not every user will mirror the needs and desires of other users.
I would also throw in the fact that I think that there needs to be the all of the issues and concerns with regard to the privacy of the users is important. But to be honest, VRM, the vision of VRM will never become a reality if the vendors don't embrace it.
If the vendors don't have what?
If the vendors don't embrace it.
Right.
It's easy enough for me to say, my website works well enough for me. I don't need to play this VRM thing. I would posit that the earlier that a story can be created for the vendors that articulates what the benefit and the value to them is, and I think that those are actually really quite clear. When you consider the amount of money that's spent by these companies to acquire customers, and now we're talking about flipping that on here and making it, extraordinarily easy in some cases to find those exact people who are shopping for what you have, the power of VRM should be readily apparent. But I would suggest that having a story as early as possible is a good thing because it, it'll make it easier to make adoption of VRM, I think, a much more viable thing.
This is Chris. To that point, and hi, everybody. Apologize for joining the call late. I've actually been working for quite a while. To that point, one of the things that leads to that key benefit to the vendors is this is the most qualified lead you will ever, ever, ever get. I mean, this is a lead that knows exactly what they're looking for. They're likely ready to buy now, you know, taking into account, the possibility of gaming the system, you know, per some of the bullwhip effect and things like that. But, I mean, I think one of the big parts of the benefit is really the same benefit that people see by doing AdWords buys on Google. You know, at that point, at its kind of skinniest and most lightweight level, that right there is an RFP for information about a particular topic, if you think about it. And Google's returning their things, and the people who have spent the money on AdWords are basically returning their response to that very, very targeted RFP, requesting information about those three, those three words that were typed in the search box. But they're highly qualified leads, and that's why people still, continue to pay money to Google for AdWords buys, because it is extremely qualified, and it's a way to get in front of people who are looking for what you might have to offer them.
Amazing that the first significant low occurs at exactly 2:30.
One other comment on the vendor side of the house as well. I think some consideration in the overall design needs to be taken with regard to how easy or difficult it is for them to interact. If a vendor has to have a human being interpret the document just so that they can respond, again, it's very unlikely that they're going to, en masse want to play ball. Now, smaller folks who, are qualified and, have time and can do that likely will still play. But I do think that, at the end of the day, to the maximum extent possible, whatever that VR, whatever that personal RFP document thing is, should be as consumable as possible. Because I think that's really where, the power again starts to come out. I want the entire collection of U2 in vinyl. Put that out there and let people run with it. But as long as they can parse that with a computer and reply with a computer, then I think we've achieved two things. One is to sort of deliver on the value of VRM, and second, created a new and ridiculously exciting new market opportunity.
So I'd like to comment on that, providing a counterexample, but also endorsing your general assertion, which is the more we can automate it, the better. I've mentioned on other calls a company called Shopatron, and they have an interesting play in vendor relationship management, and that they are reintegrating retailers into manufacturers' online stores. So I could go to Callaway Golf, buy a product there, and have it delivered by a local retailer. And so they're doing interesting things with the relationship by connecting me with a trusted local vendor. When I started at the trusted brand of Callaway and made a commitment to a transaction, it turns out part of how Shopatron addressed the integration problems of theoretically needing to know the possible inventory of all your retailers on the planet was simply to post, almost in a blog-like fashion, to those retailers who wanted to look for orders. Now, these were confirmed orders, but they basically post those orders to a website, and vendors can say, yeah, I will fulfill that order. And so an individual is involved in essentially taking these RFPs and concluding the transaction. Now, Shopatron has streamlined that, so it's extremely easy for them to do it, and they needed a lot of automated information to do that streamlining. But it's sort of a counterexample to, I don't think we can have a human touch every incoming RFP, but we do need some sort of framework to help streamline it.
Sure. Yeah, I completely agree. And, not to counter my own argument, but there may be certain situations where you know, it's not possible. And the other thing that I think is also to keep in track was this notion, you know, when you start talking about sharing history information, you know, this personal data silo, probably using that out of context, you know, that also gets into an area where, you know, how I describe the things that, you know, my favorite movies or the ratings or whatever the case may be, you know, something that can't be handled that way as well. But I think that just generally, you know, if the structure of the documents are consistent, if we can identify dictionaries that can be used consistently, you know, maybe there's this RFP widget that just draws on these resources so that you can build from a consistent set of data elements, data structures, and that sort of thing. I think that greatly simplifies the task of playing ball if you're a vendor.
Actually, if you bring up a couple good points, you mentioned dictionaries in passing. Is that something that has been addressed earlier in the call? Did you guys talk about that at all?
No, but I think it's important.
Yeah, it's absolutely critical because we, you know, we talk about, you know, someone submits an RFP or puts an RFP on their blog, or regardless of, you know, the mechanism, we're making an extreme simplifying assumption that when somebody, you know, puts up this RFP, and I'm making the huge finger quotes here, that someone on the other end can understand that it is for them, that it's something they're interested in. And there needs to be a way, you know, if I'm ordering a particular part, let's go to the absolute lowest level commodity type of example. You know, my part number, you know, I'm ordering a ream of paper, and what I call that is going to be different than Staples part number for that, which is going to be different from, you know, Office Depot's part number for that, et cetera. And so one way of solving that problem, and not saying it's the, you know, it's the only way, is to come up with, you know, sort of that lingua franca that everybody can write to, if you will, so they can all understand that they're talking about the same thing. So, I mean, that's a huge part of the problem, because otherwise we rapidly get into this, you know, kind of Tower of Babel situation, or need to have some, you know, crazy, as yet to be invented, natural language processing thing that is dealing with it. Unless, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe there is some spot in here for, you know, tagging and folksonomy, and maybe these things can kind of grow themselves. I don't know the answer to that. So it's kind of thought one. Thought two, only partially related, you know, we're talking about a lot of different ways that this could work. Everything from people going out and, you know, putting things on their blogs, and people go out and find those things a la, you know, somebody like what Edgio is doing, all the way to the other end where there's some sort of central clearinghouse. And I think one of the things that we've learned, and I'm going to mix all my metaphors up into one big ball here, I think one of the things that we learned, interestingly, from Twitter's success is they have done a really good job of providing all of the different on-ramps that are out there to get people into the system, whether it's through the web, whether it's through SMS, whether it's through IM, doesn't matter. They're providing all of these different types of on-ramps. And so I think part of our task is to think about what are the core parts that are needed. You know, I think it's representing information in some sort of consistent way, both structurally as well as semantically. So, you know, what is the structure of the XML document, assuming that's the case, as well as what are those kind of general or understandable ways of representing stuff within that structure that people can get to it, whether it's through a dictionary or something else. I see those as two kind of core things. And then I think we have the opportunity to provide a lot of organizations, a lot of interesting ways to figure out what all those different on-ramps are. So instead of us necessarily dictating, you know, it must go through Central Hub, if we kind of push things out to the edges, make things super light, and then from there, I think the, you know, the right answers and the right channels of how people get connected will kind of organically evolve. But again, one dude's opinion. And again, a deafening silence after I say something.
We need
RFP. Chris, at least from my standpoint, I'm busily trying to capture what you just wrote, and it's really hard for me to actually have an intelligent response. Because it's such good stuff, I got to get this written down.
Okay, so here's my intelligent response. Yes.
Excellent.
Chris, I was actually thinking how cogent and well phrased what you said was, and how I couldn't improve upon it.
Just because I feel like saying this, you kiss ass. No, my point is I also really like the point about the various on-ramps. I mean, we live in a hub-and-spoke world, and we have no way of knowing where people are going to need access, want access, or we should not presume the human behavior of the way whatever structure will take off. So it has to adjust to that and be flexible to that.
We may have a name for this thing. It's RSRFPS. Really?
Oh, that just rolls right off the – that just freaking rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, how would you pronounce that?
Cluster or something, something.
I think that's named after that character from the other dimension in the Superman comic.
Exactly.
Hey, acronyms are exactly what they're for.
So, actually, I do want to comment on this dictionary problem because I'm going to be submitting a proposal here to try and get some funding to address part of that. And I'm curious. Now, Chris, my guess is you're familiar with microformats?
Indeed, very much so.
So microformats is what I would call a canonical approach. I mean, they do a whole bunch of other things, but with regard to this issue of dictionaries, it's about forging a single consensus about what, say, a class name means in the dictionary space. And I'm actually going to be pursuing, and I want to share this with the group and suggest this as a mechanism in this architecture, is rather than a single consensus, have explicit mechanisms to translate between vernaculars.
Okay, keep going.
So, for example, when I I'm looking at this in the context of also breaking down web-based data silos so that you can automatically extract your information from Netflix and Amazon and Blockbuster or what have you. And one of the problems with that is all of those sites, you can use a screen scraper to get at some of that data. But all of the labels are, whether it's semantic or it's just encoded in the HTML, you need some way first to extract the data into something that's meaningful, such that, you know, the content of this tag at Amazon is the title of a movie. But then you also need some sort of common way amongst those three different websites, in this example, to know that, hey, these three things are all titles of movies.
Yep, exactly.
So my mental model is, at the first layer, you need to translate from those data silos into a shared dictionary. But there doesn't need to be a single shared dictionary. There simply needs to be translation capability between possible dictionaries, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Because
at the
beginning, I'm translating from the website into a dictionary. Hopefully it's shared. Mm-hmm. But I could also translate again as long as that entire process is essentially lossless.
Right.
So
right.
I
would think there can be any number of those sorts of representations of stuff, you know, whether we call them dictionaries or what have you. You know, going back to the movie title example, you might say, I am looking for, you know, I want to buy, Superman 3. You know, and of course everybody's going to mock you, but notwithstanding, putting up, the title and the format you're looking for and what have you. Again, looking at the RFP example, there might be a number of different formats that represent those sorts of things. I don't know if we can necessarily guarantee that they're going to be isomorphic and lossless between the different things. And
correct.
You know, if people out on the edges just state when they're putting things up there, here is the this particular representation is using this particular dictionary/microformat, then people can be listening, you know, the vendors can be listening for that. If they, the vendors then, you know, if they're doing things using a different format, they can do the translation themselves, or they might know that, you know, through this two-step process, they can get to the format they need, or, you know, there might be a whole ecosystem of, you know, VRM Babel fishes that get genned up out there that people just create to translate between these different things. I don't think we can guarantee them to be lossless, but at the same time, you know, if the key parts that need to go from format A to format B are out there, then someone will fill the gap and make that translator, would be my guess.
Right. That's absolutely right. And part of sort of my approach and how I'm trying to use sort of social processes and the VRM user-centric mentality is specifically to allow third parties to attach that particular translator to a particular asset.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who writes a translator that can go from an Amazon listing into some data set should be able to register that somewhere so that other people could also leverage that translation.
Exactly. Now,
there are all
exactly.
sorts of quality control issues and whatnot, but you know, I don't want to sidetrack everything into this, but this is a problem I'm chewing on, and hopefully we'll be sharing as it develops with this community.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you get to kind of the whole going back to the early AI stuff. You can, if you know what's out there and you know what you're trying to, you know, do to get there are whole sorts of kind of backward chaining things you could go through to see if you can get there from where you are. So if it's something's in the Amazon format and you know you need it in the IMDb format, just making that up, if there are if there's an Amazon to IMDb translator, cool. But if there's an Amazon to Walmart translator and there's a Walmart to IMDb translator, then that path could be, you know, could be followed as well. And so if you know what all those different translators are out there, you can back into the answer.
Yep.
This is Keith Hopper. Another interesting potential approach, is obviously there's a huge problem on eBay. I mean, it's the world's biggest retailer without any SKUs. Is to another organic, perhaps, way to do this is to publish the transaction sort of anonymously. So remove perhaps some identification information that may not be relevant, look at the RFP query and actual end purchase, and then publish that information. Use it similar in the same way that Google crawls pages to determine and to take PageRank information and link it back to popularity of search results and their relevance to your search. You could do the same thing with transactions. I don't know if that made any sense, but
no, I didn't follow. Part of it was because I'm still trying to type here. But could you touch on it again?
Sure. So let's say that I have put out an RFP for a pair of running shoes and a very specific style, running style, clothing style, all that stuff that I want, price that I want. But you know, shoes can have a lot of different semantic meanings. Running can have a lot of different meanings. So let's say that, although it probably wasn't a very good example. A match is ultimately made. For example, you know, someone responds to my RFP, I go, that's exactly what I wanted. I make the purchase. If that information is published, if that transaction is published in such a way that I'm comfortable with, right, so it doesn't carry along, say, personally identifiable information into some sort of repository or crawlable index, then the next time somebody uses semantic meaning similar to mine, an automatic potential translation is made to the purchase that solved my problem, might be relevant to the other person's problem, not to market to them, but to find a semantic link.
Oh, absolutely. So what you're saying is that your solution is implicitly a recommendation for others who have similar RFPs.
Basically, yeah. I mean, obviously that gets exploited in all sorts of sort of top-down ways. But there's no need for it to be strictly in a top-down environment. I mean, it can be used in this sort of environment as well.
Absolutely. Who was that?
This is Keith.
That was Keith.
Yeah.
Yeah. That scarily parallels some of our approaches that we're using at Switchbook to provide recommendations to users as
right.
they're searching the web. I mean, inherently, what you're talking about is a way to generate organic recommendations based on past successes at resolving RFPs.
Right, and I guess all I'm saying is that that's obviously no different than you know, a lot of the recommendation engines and collaborative filtering stuff out there. I think there are two primary differences. One is you're looking for, this is specifically around the dictionary problem. So you're looking for ways to sort of organically determine semantic links. So I searched for mouse, did I mean computer mouse or furry mouse? Well, I found success, so the next person that uses the word mouse, maybe they're looking for the same thing I'm looking for. And then the second piece of it is that it's done in a decentralized way, in the same way that, say, Google crawls sites. Maybe it's, you know, the goal isn't to give Amazon another tool to provide, you know, top-down vendor recommendations to you, but rather as a tool for the end user to take advantage of by essentially, I don't know what the interface would look like, but perhaps some sort of you know, natural links or semantic suggestions on how to modify your RFP to find what you're looking for.
Very cool.
I should point out that we've been on a little over an hour, and I just got an email, by the way, from Alan Mitchell, who said he couldn't get on. Did anyone else have any trouble dialing in? I take that as a group no. It could be after a certain amount of time. One just can't join. I don't know. So I, what I'd like to do is see if there's anyone who hasn't said anything that would like to add anything to the conversation, or does anybody feel there's something we haven't covered that we should cover today?
I would like to put a stake in the ground about the IAW in 2 weeks.
And what does that stake in the ground imply?
Just to raise it again in the consciousness of folks here.
Now, is that, I'm sorry, Joe, is that stake STAKE or STEAK?
Whichever works. We could have a stake at the IAW if you want. I wanted to get it in the conversation that I think a lot of us are going to be at the IAW, and I'm pretty sure Doc's going to be there, and we'll be touching on a lot of these topics there as well.
Yep. Yep.
And that's going to be where?
Mountain View at the Computer History Museum, I think the 14th through the 16th.
Oh, so that's right around the corner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, week after next.
Yeah, which is why I definitely wanted to make sure if folks can make that but haven't heard of it or thought about it, I encourage you to do so. At the last IAW, we had some very interesting VRM-related conversations.
And IAW is Internet Identity Workshop, right?
Yes.
Yep.
And I'll put a link to that in the meeting notes. I don't know it offhand.
Will that get in the way of a May 16th call?
I think so, actually.
All right, so we won't have a May 16th call. I think that I would suggest that this has been a very beneficial call. I know there's a few people I'm going to ask to listen to the audio, and I wonder if we should have our call on the 9th, a week from today, and keep the momentum going. Thoughts?
Works for me.
Sure.
I mean, I would actually highlight that I've missed a couple of these, and it's frustrating to not have had the been able to tap into the continuing momentum and energy. So
yeah, next week works for me too. I just need to check. I might be on a flight on Wednesday, but barring that, I think it's a good idea.
Okay, so I've made a note here, and I'll Joe, something tells me you and I will be collaborating this evening on some wiki things. So we'll make sure to get that posted.
Okay. That sounds good. I should be available. So I've got a couple of things to put into the notes that aren't quite ready yet, just because our conversation's flowed ahead of it. But are there any action items that we've touched on? The only one I know of is Ben Laurie pointed to a Jabber host that we could use, so I'm going to go look at that.
Oh, very good. It's funny because I was going to say that we need to have Doc nudge the people at Berkman on that.
Yeah, so Ben mentioned that he had a he's had to sign off now, but that he has a site we can use, and I just need to go and figure it out. So I'll try and make some progress on that. Hopefully by next Wednesday we'll have a back channel on Jabber.
Cool.
During the call.
All right, I would also recommend everybody, please, you all have emails from me. Please feel free to send me, you know, a thought hits you, you're sitting at your computer, send me an email. I'll put it on the agenda. I have no problem with that. I welcome that and encourage that.
Cool.
Excellent.
All right, I think then we should draw to a close. 2:55, we're actually on time. It's amazing.
Wacky.
Imagine that.
All right, so I thank everybody, and I should get the I have two goals here. One is to collect the audio and then to get it to Britt so he can have a transcript made, which we, you know, again thank him for. He's donating that service to us. Also, I do want to point out, I forgot to say earlier, Drummond said he couldn't make it. He's at a face-to-face meeting in Austin. Which you may recall last time we convened, he said he was going to be on the East Coast, and that was Austin.
Talking like a true Californian.
Yes. All right, so that's the scoop there, and I thank everybody. Keep looking at the wiki, and we will see you then a week from today. Same time, same place, same phone number. Oh, and by the way, please, and thank you so far, do not publish this number. This number will remain the number for the short term.
Okay.
All right,
everybody, thank you very much. I'll see you next week. Otherwise, I'm sure we'll be IMing, phone calling, and emailing between then.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, y'all.
So long, all.